Hello, this is your priest and pastor at the Fort Church of St. Martin's Parish, Father Nick. Grace and peace to you. And I have with me, as always, the Reverend Dr. Ross Wright to help me discuss and explore with you all how do we get the New Testament. And so today we're going to be talking about the Gospel according to John and the three epistles of John. So you'll find the Gospel according to John. It's the fourth gospel, the fourth book in the New Testament. And then if you want to find the epistles of John, you have to jump all the way towards the back of the New Testament right before the book of Revelation to find 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. But that's what we'll be talking about today. Ross, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about the Gospel of John and the epistles. Are some of my favorite material in the New Testament.
Excellent. Well, so I mentioned that it's the fourth gospel, and it really, if you're reading through the New Testament, like I did, say when I was, I guess around the age of 15, and I finally picked up the New Testament and decided to read straight through it. And if you do that and you read Matthew and then Mark and you read Luke and you think, well, these are all telling kind of the same story, you know, they have some different emphases, they have some different content, but it's basically the same. And then you get to John and it's right off the bat, a totally different experience in terms of reading a gospel. It has a different feel, a different language to it in a sense, different phraseology. Its picture of Jesus seems very different. And I can point out some of those, but Ross, how about you? Is that your experience also if you can think back to when you first read the Gospels?
Yes, it is strikingly different to read John. And several qualities about the Gospel of John are immediately evident to anyone who's read the Synoptics and then takes the plunge into John. One difference is that there are these really long discourse sections. We talked about that in Matthew, that Matthew has narrative events followed by discourse, but in John's gospel, the discourses are even longer and they're joined together in the second half of the book. So the first half is often referred to as the book of signs, where there's seven miracles, miraculous signs that Jesus does. And then the second half of the book, from basically chapter 10 on, is referred to as the book of glory. And it's essentially a series of long discourses that Jesus gives without any narrative bits at all. So that's one obvious difference. It's set up differently. There's also a kind of almost mystical element, I think, to the Gospel of John. Mystics apparently have historically loved the Gospel of John because it goes into some of the details about who Jesus is and some of the sort of inner relationships between Jesus and the Father. And the Spirit. I heard it put rather simply and succinctly this way, that if people ask the question, what did Jesus do? Then it's natural to pick up the Gospel of Mark, maybe, or one of the other synoptics. But if the question is, who is Jesus at the core of his identity? Then the Gospel of John really comes into focus or is featured as a particularly powerful reflection on Jesus' relationship with the Father. We get prayers that he prayed. We get a whole different side of Jesus than comes across in the synoptics. A couple other just specific details that you might not notice the first time through when you're reading and noticing the differences between the gospel and the synoptics. One difference, and Nick has referred to this in earlier discussions, in the synoptic gospels, Jesus' activity revolves around the area of the Galilee. And his ministry, his public ministry, lasts about a year. Whereas in the Gospel of John, Jesus is constantly going in and out of Jerusalem. And so a lot of the activity, a lot of the narrative activity in John's Gospel occurs in Jerusalem. And it's over a much longer period of time, about 3 years. There's some differences in the ordering of the material. We talked about the cleansing of the temple, how in the synoptics it occurs towards the very end of of Jesus' public ministry and is the kind of precipitating event for the final opposition, excuse me, the final opposition that leads to his death. Whereas in John's gospel, it occurs very early on in the second chapter. And another event entirely is the one that is the precipitating event. It's a miracle of the healing of a man born blind. So we get these really significant shifts in the ordering of material. There are also some differences in the character of Jesus' ministry in John's gospel. For example, in the synoptics, John frequently exorcises demons. And in John's gospel, I think I'm correct that there are no exorcisms as there are in the synoptics. So anyway, these are some obvious differences. I don't want to overplay the differences because there are plenty of similarities. John's gospel and the synoptics provide a recognizable Jesus. It's the same Jesus. And the essential shape, where you have the baptism of Jesus, baptism of John, you have the public ministry, you have the passion and the resurrection, that essential structure is the same. So I don't want to overplay the differences, but it's just to point out that if you pick up John, it's really different. And it takes a little, it's a little bit like listening to a different style of music or hearing something in a different key. It takes a little while for your ears to get accustomed to John's particular way of communicating things. But it's a wonderful gospel and a rich gospel, and has been really important in the church's understanding of Jesus as the incarnate Son of God and of Jesus' self-understanding.
Yeah, great. I think that's right. And I do think that, I mean, you know, as you say, we don't want to overemphasize the difference, but it is pretty striking, the things that you pointed out, that the Jesus of the synoptics, a big part of his healing is its connection to exorcisms, to casting out unclean spirits, as they're called in Mark's gospel, or demons. And as you point out, there's no exorcisms in John. There are healings, but these healings aren't seen as being in, you know, part of an umbrella of that includes exorcisms. You know, the way Jesus teaches is so different, as you pointed out, the long discourses, and sometimes Greek wordplay that happens in John's gospel, where Jesus will use a phrase and he'll kind of play on the ambiguity of meaning. We see this with Nicodemus. Jesus says, you know, you have to be, in some translations render it as born again, and some translations born from above. And the words can, the Greek can mean either one. And so I've even seen some translations that try and put them together, born again from above. But of course, Nicodemus in that passage misunderstands because he takes it too literally and thinks, how can you be born again? You can't, he says, you can't crawl into your mother's womb and be born a second time. And of course, this shows his misunderstanding, his lack of understanding, even though he's supposed to be a teacher of Israel. So we get some interesting wordplay. It also shows up in Jesus speaks about being lifted up. On the one hand, this means lifted up on the cross, where he's actually, you know, a crucified victim is, you know, suspended from the cross about a, you know, his feet are, or maybe about a foot off the ground. So he's actually lifted up, and he likens this to the serpent, the bronze serpent that's lifted up on the staff by Moses to heal the Israelites of snake bites. But of course, lifted up also has this added or deeper meaning of being exalted, and how Jesus will be exalted to the right hand of the Father. And so he's playing with words in this way. He's giving long discourses. But as you pointed out, Ross, he never tells a parable. In the whole gospel, he just doesn't teach in the way that he teaches in the other gospels. He uses figures of speech. He likens himself to a vine, to a gate, to the good shepherd. He uses all of these figures of speech or analogies, but he doesn't tell the parables we're so used to hearing him tell, and somewhat in Mark, and then definitely in Matthew and Luke. So it really does feel in that sense like a different kind of gospel. I want to return to some of those themes that you raised, Ross, in terms of the differences, but also the similarities, this discussion of the book of signs and the book of glory and the role of signs within the gospel. But I wonder if we can take a quick detour for a minute and just talk about some of the nuts and bolts. Who wrote it? When was it written? Where was it written? Those kinds of questions that we've tried to deal with since our topic isn't just the New Testament, but also how do we get the New Testament? What are your thoughts on that?
I just had a quick correction. I think I gave the wrong chapter break for the Book of Glory and the Book of Signs. The Book of Glory starts at chapter 12, right? I think I said chapter 10, but anyway, it's the division is after the raising of Lazarus. That's the last sign. The raising of Lazarus is chapter 11. So you get chapter 2 to chapter 11 are the signs, and then you get the Book of Glory. Sorry. But back to authorship, is that where you wanted to go next?
Yeah, I just thought maybe we could cover that real quick, and then sure. We move on to the more interesting question of these kind of themes and structure. Yeah.
Yeah, the thing of authorship, it's a complicated question in John's gospel because it also touches some of the other literature that is associated with John. In addition to the Gospel of John, there are three epistles associated with the name of John, and there's also the Book of Revelation. And there are different theories about whether these were all written by the same person or not. But as we think about authorship of the Gospel of John, I think it's important to remember that it's a somewhat more complicated question because we're talking about the connection between several different documents. The church's traditional pre-critical stance, in other words, prior to the 19th century, was that the Gospel of John was written by the Apostle John, the son of Zebedee, shortly before his death, and essentially by memory. In other words, he had in his mind the events that he'd observed. There's a reference in John's Gospel to it being written by an eyewitness. And so the church assumed that it was John the Apostle, and it was a fairly straightforward theory of authorship. But since the 19th century, as we've talked about in this course many times, there have been critical tools of history applied to these documents and some different theories about authorship. And one immediate question that comes up that's even was the case before the critical period was that John, the Gospel of John, seems to have several layers of composition. There is what appears to be the ending of John's Gospel in chapter 20. There's a conclusion. And then there's another chapter, chapter 21, which is written in a different style and then has another conclusion. And so it appears that there's something going on with the several different voices or stages of composition. The theory that I find the most plausible is that there were a series of documents written in the same more or less geographical area, Asia Minor. And I'm talking about the Gospel of John, the Epistles of John, and probably the Book of Revelation. And these documents all trace their roots back to the same person, which is probably the Apostle John, the beloved apostle. But that the documents themselves were probably written in a complex, layered process, which we can go into in some more detail. But that theory makes the most sense to me because there are a lot of similar themes across these writings, Revelation, Epistles, and John. And by the way, for this session, we're going to not talk about Revelation. We're going to really limit ourselves to the Gospel of John and the Epistles. But there do seem to be some thematic similarities and some stylistic similarities. So it makes sense to me to think of these documents and these communities around which the documents arose, tracing themselves back to the same person. But whether John himself actually wrote the documents is questionable. I mean, I think it was probably some sort of community that rose up around John, and then different people were writing the documents. But I'm going to let you take it into some more detail on that one, Nick, because you've got some specific proposals for us to consider. What do you think?
Yeah, so I know we've mentioned before that there are some suggestions. Bishop John A.T. Robinson, when he was alive, had suggested an extremely early date for John, even given what we would call Johannine priority, suggesting John, the Gospel of John, was written the earliest. That's not a proposal that the majority of scholars or really any scholars that I know of have accepted. One of the things that's difficult about dating the gospel according to John is the fact that it doesn't have the literary relationship that the other synoptic or that the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke have. So once you make a decision with the synoptic gospels about which one was written first, then you know the others were written afterwards, and you can make an educated guess about the length of time that the original text, let's say Mark, since that's the way that we've tended to go, that Mark was written first, you can make an educated guess about how long it would take for that text to be copied and distributed and eventually make its way as a source for Matthew and Luke. We don't really have the ability to do that with John because we don't see that tight relationship. Actually, I think it's John A.T. Robinson who described the New Testament, the dating of the New Testament text, as being like a group that's just left the pub late at night. And they've had a little too much to drink, so they saunter back and forth, but they're all kind of together. So, you know, if one moves this way, the whole group kind of veers this way, and if the other, then they veer that way. And that's certainly true with the Synoptic Gospels, right? If your dating for Mark goes early, then Matthew and Luke go early. If your dating for Mark goes late, then your dating for Matthew and Luke go later, and so on. It's not quite as clear with John. And so it makes it more difficult. I would say that the majority of scholars now would place the dating somewhere between 80 and 100. And maybe with a kind of, this is almost an arbitrary number, but maybe with a preference to about 95 CE or AD for when it was written. There's a couple reasons why they tend to date it later. One of those reasons I find convincing, and another one I find not very convincing. So I'll start with the one that I find not as convincing. The not so convincing reason for dating it later is that the Gospel according to John clearly has a very high Christology. And by that I mean the view of Jesus that is represented in the Gospel according to John is clearly as Jesus as the incarnation of the divine. You can get into debates about whether the Gospel writer had a proto-Trinitarian view or something slightly different, but putting those debates aside, it's very clear that Jesus, the very first verse, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then the Word, takes flesh and dwells among us. This is a very high Christology. Unexpectedly, you might even say, for how soon after Jesus' death and resurrection. And so scholars will say it's a higher Christology than what we find in other books of the New Testament, and you need more time for that kind of high Christology to develop. I hope that by this point, we have disabused y'all who've been watching us of that notion, that we've already seen in some of the very earliest texts very high Christologies. You know, when Paul is possibly quoting an older hymn used by the Philippian community, there's already this sense of Christ's incarnation, that he's divine but doesn't consider his divinity something to be grasped or held onto, but empties himself and takes on the form of a human being in Philippians chapter 2. We talked about that. And we've also talked about how there's a high Christology even in the Synoptic Gospels. So I really don't buy the fact that we have to date John late because of the high Christology. It seems to me that high Christology is all across the first century, and there's it's not something that needed time to develop. But there is another reason why it gets dated to later, and that has to do with the conflicts that it reflects on, and particularly the conflicts with the larger Jewish community. John does seem to be at a place, and we've already talked about how running through the New Testament is a kind of tension around the relationship between Jewish Christians, Gentile Christians, and then non-Christian Jews. This, you know, and to what extent are they connected? And if you're a Jewish Christian, are you more closely aligned with your non-Christian Jewish neighbors and friends and family? Or are you more closely aligned with your Christian Gentile friends? This is an issue that runs throughout the New Testament. And in John, we really see it, I think, in a late stage of development, where we have in John's gospel the ability for the Johannine community to look at their fellow Jews who are not Christians and simply call them the Jews, which is not the way that, and you don't see that in the Synoptic Gospels. In Matthew and Mark and Luke, specific groups are listed: the Pharisees, the scribes, the Sadducees, the high priest and the temple priesthood. These groups are called out, but you never just have a sweeping statement about the Jews. By John's gospel, you do. And that seems to suggest a later date. Before I move on, Ross, did you want to say anything about that?
Yes. Like you, I'm convinced that this heightened conflict between believers in Jesus, Jewish believers in Jesus, and those who rejected Jesus as the Messiah is the context for John's gospel. And we actually do have a couple of documents that give us some pretty specific dating for this. We mentioned in earlier sessions that the destruction of the temple in 70 AD marked the end of a lot of traditions within Judaism and the ascendance of the Pharisees. The Pharisees became the leading sect among various Jewish groups. And we know that there were a lot of tensions between Jesus and the Pharisees. And there's a document called the 18 Benedictions, which was said in the synagogues following the destruction of Jerusalem temple. And there's one in particular that is a curse on heretics, which we think was used specifically in relation to those who believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And the date of that is around 85. It's the Birkat Haminim, one of the 18 benedictions, a curse on heretics. And it was primarily a Jewish Christian issue that was being worked out here. So you can imagine a Jewish believer attending a synagogue service and being asked to pronounce this curse upon himself, basically, as part of the Jewish synagogue prayer routine. And so this was a bitter, difficult conflict where Jewish believers had been essentially thrown out of the synagogue. They were being looked at as being heretics. And this conflict, we see a lot of evidence of it in the Gospel of John. And the date 85, which is the date that we have for this particular benediction, one of the benedictions that was the curse on non-believers, helps us locate the dating of the gospel.
Yeah, and we should also mention a couple things about that. So the New Testament scholar that we've mentioned before, Amy Jill Levine, has pointed out that there's no evidence that this was used in all synagogues all over the Roman Empire, right? We don't have any evidence that this was that they were even coordinated in that way, that the synagogues were coordinated enough that all of them would have the same text to make these things. But it's certainly possible that the community that the Gospel of John represents, the Johannine community, would have been a community in relationship to one of the synagogues that would have used this. And that would explain some of that tension there. The other thing that I want to point out is that that's not a strange thing to do in the ancient world. That's a fairly normal thing to do. And that's something that the Christian church ended up doing also. And we still do it. So whenever we say the creed, the Nicene Creed in church, and we say about Jesus that he is God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father, through him all things were made, for us and for our salvation, he came down from heaven, and so on. That language that we use, and there's a particular Greek word that gets translated as of one being with the Father. The Greek word is homoousion, that Jesus is homoousion with the Father, of one being. That language was carefully chosen by the councils of Nicaea and Constantinople because it would be impossible for a certain type of Christian known as an Arian Christian, after the teacher, a priest or presbyter named Arius, they would not be able to say that because in good conscience, because it would go against their theology. So it was a way of distinguishing which type of church you're in. If they say, if you go into this church, and you might not know whether it's an Arian church or what we would now call a Nicene church, or we might now call it a, you know, Catholic or Orthodox, you know, with a small c, small o church. You might not know just by walking in, but once the creed was said and you heard homoousion, you knew you were not in an Arian church. And if you held Arian beliefs, you might want to keep your mouth shut and not let folks know, because it wouldn't go over well. So that it's just part of the ancient world to make those kinds of statements. I say ancient world. I mean, in some ways, it's still part of our world. I mean, we saw it in the Reformation with the writing of confessions, like the Augsburg Confession, the Westminster Confession, ways of identifying this is our community and what we believe. So I just wanted to kind of mention those two things. Ross, unless you wanted to add something on, I was going to talk about authorship now.
Please, go right ahead.
Okay. So you may have guessed we're going to talk about whether or not we should be calling this, well, not whether or not we should be calling it, but whether or not when we call this the Gospel according to John, we're actually attributing authorship to John. As you might expect, I think a lot of modern scholars, maybe the majority of modern scholars, do not think that the author of the Gospel according to John was John, although it's not even entirely clear which John we might be talking about. You know, as with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, modern scholars tend to think this is probably an anonymous author. But from the second century on, the name of John has been attached to this text, and not just this text, but the epistles. So I wanted to kind of talk about that a little bit, because the other thing that's done is that we associate John with a character that shows up in the text, who we sometimes refer to as a beloved disciple. Although the text itself usually calls him the disciple whom Jesus loved. And we don't need to kind of get into all the different, there's not actually too many texts that mention him. And I can go ahead and list those texts. He's mentioned in John 13 verses 23 to 35, in John 19, 26 to 27, in John 21 to 10, in John 21, 1 to 14, and finally in John 21, 20 to 24. And maybe it might be worthwhile to read that last one. Ross, would you be willing to do that? That's John chapter 21, verses 20 to 24.
Should be glad to.
And just to set this up, this is after Jesus has been raised from the dead, and he's speaking with Peter.
Sorry, I'm using a different Bible, and its pages are sticking together.
That was me last week.
Okay, and so I got the right chat. Where shall I start?
21 verse 20, and just go to 24.
Okay. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had been reclining at table close to him, and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is it to you? You follow me." So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him he was not to die, but "It is my will that he remain. If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?"
Will you read the verse 24 also?
Sure. "And this is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true."
So we see here a couple things that we see in this passage right at the very end of the Gospel according to John. It associates the text with the beloved disciple. And we hear a little bit from the community about how many in the community expected that he might not die before the Lord's return. The fact that the writer of this ending section, which you've already mentioned, Ross, was probably added on later, has to say, well, Jesus didn't necessarily mean that he wasn't going to, that the beloved disciple wasn't going to die before Jesus's return. He just meant to say that if that was his will, then that would be the case. Suggests that the beloved disciple by this point, by the time that this last epilogue of the gospel has been attached to it, the beloved disciple has died. The texts are a reliable witness to what he had told them about Jesus. So the real question is, who then is this beloved disciple who is supposedly the main voice that has preserved the traditions that show up in the gospel according to John, and that the gospel according to John takes great pains to show is a more important, excuse me, a more important leader or a greater leader than other leaders. We see, especially in the resurrection stories of Jesus, the stories around Jesus's resurrection in the gospel according to John, we find named certain leaders of the early church, apostolic leaders of the church that we know of. Peter, of course, Thomas, who has a tradition of leadership, and Mary Magdalene, who also has a tradition of leadership within the early church, not mentioned by Paul, but mentioned by other texts. And so what we see in the gospel according to John is the beloved disciple is always one-upping these other supposed leaders. An example is Mary Magdalene doesn't recognize the risen Jesus when she first sees him. She's the first to see him, but she doesn't recognize him. But what we see in chapter 21 is a scene where none of the disciples recognize the risen Jesus except the beloved disciple, who immediately recognizes him, right? So we see that the beloved disciple, unlike the other leaders, including Mary Magdalene, is able to recognize the risen Jesus right away. There's the story of Peter and the beloved disciple. When they get the news of the empty tomb, they race to the empty tomb. We've heard about Peter racing to the empty tomb in another gospel, but here it's Peter and the beloved disciple together. They're running to it, and the beloved disciple beats Peter there. He's swifter. He gets there sooner. He does wait and let Peter empty the tomb first, but then he follows him behind. But he kind of one-ups Peter. And similarly, we see Thomas doesn't believe. We get the doubting Thomas story here in John's gospel. And we'll talk a little bit about doubting Thomas, I think, when we move on to talking about the epistles and some of the issues the epistles deal with. But his doubts kind of, again, the beloved disciple believes as soon as he hears, but Thomas has to wait and put his hands, it says he has to see with his own eyes and put his hands in the wounds. So the beloved disciple kind of one-ups the other apostles. And this seems to be a way of kind of lifting him up as a leader above the leaders. But who is he? Well, that's the real question. I'll come to the main, you know, tradition which identifies him with John in a second, but I want to talk about a couple other traditions real quick. One of those traditions, one tradition that we've seen, and particularly that was lifted up more recently by Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code, is that the beloved disciple is Mary Magdalene. And so this comes from the fact that we see at what we would call the Last Supper, the disciple whom Jesus loves is leaning against him. Actually, the Greek suggests that he's resting upon his bosom, resting upon Jesus's chest. This, by the way, is a similar Greek phrase as what we see at the very beginning of the gospel, where we find that it's used about Jesus and the Father. That Jesus rests upon the Father's bosom. So there's almost this kind of, if you want to know the Father, you have to know Jesus. And if you want to know Jesus, you have to know the beloved disciple. This kind of ladder of ascent there. But Da Vinci, as we all know, has represented this in his Last Supper painting. Dan Brown, the novelist, made a big deal about this, that the beloved disciple doesn't have a beard. Now, usually, traditionally, that's because the beloved disciple is seen as being young, and therefore his beard hasn't come in. But Dan Brown decides that must mean that the beloved disciple is a woman. Well, which woman is it going to be? There's not too many women besides Jesus's mother who are named in the gospel. So let's make the beloved disciple Mary Magdalene, which is part of the story of the Da Vinci Code. And no historian, by the way, takes that seriously. Nor is it likely that Mary Magdalene is the beloved disciple, because Mary Magdalene is mentioned in this text. The beloved disciple seems to be someone else than who is mentioned. So another suggestion that's been made is perhaps it's Lazarus. Lazarus is mentioned in the text, but Lazarus is mentioned, as Ross said, in chapter 12. That's the raising of Lazarus. And we hear that Jesus especially loved Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus. And so this kind of lends weight to the suggestion that perhaps Lazarus is the beloved disciple. And then we don't hear about Lazarus anymore after chapter 12, and that's when we start hearing about the beloved disciple, beginning in chapter 13. So those who hold to this view think that that's fine. Again, it seems to me that the connection would have been made more clearly in the text if that were true. The beloved disciple seems to be a different person than anyone who's named in the text. With that said, one thing that people have pointed out is that John, the brother of James, the son of Zebedee, is not mentioned in this gospel. And we know that this John is an important person because Paul lists this John as one of the pillars of the church who are in Jerusalem that he goes to see. James the Just, the brother of Jesus, is one. Peter is one. And John, the son of Zebedee, is one. And so we know that John was an important figure in the early church. We know that he was considered a pillar, one of the leading apostles. And so the idea is, well, he's not mentioned in this gospel, but we have this beloved disciple. Perhaps the beloved disciple then is John. And we do see in the second century texts, from Papias, who we've mentioned before, Papias, who is a bishop who wrote, and his writings have been preserved in part by Eusebius, the historian, and I think Irenaeus was the other person who preserved some of his writings. He suggests, or he has a lineage connected to this John, as does Polycarp, another important Christian leader that we'll talk about perhaps when we talk about the letters of Ignatius of Antioch. By the second century, the name of John is being attached to this gospel. Although Papias, we should say, also mentions a John the Elder, or John the Presbyteros, the presbyter, which is a name that we'll see when we get to the epistles of John. They are written by somebody who refers to himself as the elder, or the presbyteros, the presbyter. So is this John the elder? Is this John the evangelist? That is John the apostle, the son of Zebedee? Or is it someone else that we don't know? These are questions that are up in the air. And that also would determine where this text might have been written. Those who lean towards an actual Johannine provenance might suggest that this was written in Ephesus, because there seems to be a connection between John and Ephesus, but we really don't know. Ross, do you have any other thoughts about that before we move on?
No, I think the various theories about which John this is, a number of scholars will say, make statements like, we cannot disprove that it was John the apostle, son of Zebedee, nor can we prove it. So it's one of these questions that remains open, and you know, we'll never know for sure.
Right. And again, when we say right, we don't necessarily mean the person who put the words down on papyrus or vellum. That could just mean the person who dictated the words to a secretary who then wrote them down and perhaps did some editing and compiling and so on. Ross, would you like to move on to possible sources, or do you want to talk about themes now?
Well, let's talk a little bit about sources. Okay. I think we can dispense with this fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the relationship between John and the synoptics, that there are these striking differences as well as some areas of overlap. And so scholars have raised the question about the possible literary relationship between John and the synoptics. And the theory that makes the most sense to me has been articulated most thoroughly by a scholar named Raymond Brown, a Roman Catholic scholar, in his two-volume commentary on the Gospel of John. It was first published in the 60s, and it's been through, I think, the second edition. And his theory, it's not only his theory, but this one that he develops rather thoroughly, is that John was drawing on a tradition about the words and deeds of Jesus that was independent from the traditions that the synoptics used. Remember, we talked about the synoptics had material that they drew on, oral traditions, some of them written traditions, the Q document, if it was in fact a document. And the theory that Brown is proposing is that John was also drawing on oral and written traditions, but they were different sources from those that the synoptics used. And this would explain why there are these striking differences between the synoptics and John, while at the same time explaining the overlap and areas of similarity. So the theory here is that there was some other tradition that we don't have access to that John used independently of the synoptics. That theory makes a lot of sense to me. It doesn't appear that John was dependent on Matthew, Mark, or Luke. It just, we don't see the kinds of obvious blocks of material that we can identify when we talk about the synoptic problem. But it does make sense that John might have drawn on a different tradition. An ancillary question or related question is whether John's material is historically accurate. And for a long time, scholars just assumed that John's material was less historically reliable than that of the synoptics. But some recent scholarship has raised questions about that and called for a reevaluation about the accuracy of John's details. And there's some evidence that on questions where John was considered rather naive or perhaps inaccurate, he was actually quite accurate. For example, his description of the Samaritans, the culture of the Samaritans in chapter 4, remember the famous story of the Samaritan woman, that seems to check out with what we know about the Samaritans from other sources. So this is just one example of how John is beginning to look more reliable than perhaps was once thought historically.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, we mentioned how Luke doesn't seem to actually be aware of the geography and topography of the Galilee and Judea. Israel in the first century, or Syria, Palestina in the first century. But John has interesting little details all throughout his gospel that show a kind of knowledge or awareness of aspects of the culture and of the area and of the temple and so on that that are really surprising, and we don't have a source that we know of that he was drawing from. So it does kind of lend some weight to perhaps some traditions that stretch back. Maybe even eyewitness traditions are being represented in the gospel according to John.
Nick, what do you think about the John using an independent tradition from the synoptics? Does that sound plausible to you?
Well, so, I've actually got some weird theories about this. maybe first let me just mention, so we've talked about how you can divide John's gospel up into a prologue, a book of signs, a book of glory, and then a kind of epilogue. That book of signs has, and certain comments made within the gospel according to John have suggested to some people, and I think maybe we've mentioned him at least in our discussion, Wednesday night discussions, but the New Testament scholar from the early 20th century or the first half of the 20th century, Rudolf Bultmann, I think may have been the first to suggest this, that John was drawing on that the Book of Signs represents actually a source. That some scholars have referred to as the Gospel of Signs, and that this becomes the kind of the poles that around which he clusters the different parts or sections of his gospel, and this Gospel of Signs may have predated the text. So one thing that we might want to just kind of mention about that before I talk about the relation to the synoptics is that in the synoptic gospels, when Jesus does something that we would call a miracle, nail, it's referred to in the Greek as dunamis. This is the word from which we get the word dynamite. And it means essentially a deed of power. So Jesus does deeds of power. I like this language, by the way, more than the language of miracles, because we have a very modern notion of miracles. I know this is kind of an aside, but it's worth mentioning. We understand as modern people, quote unquote modern people, that miracles are breaks in the laws of nature. The trouble with applying that definition onto the New Testament or any ancient text is that the idea of laws, fixed laws of nature, comes from the early modern period, from the work of people like Sir Isaac Newton, who give us, in a slightly different way, the philosopher David Hume, who give us a view of the world as a kind of mechanism that works according to certain immutable laws. And in that sense, then a miracle is when those laws break down or something happens against those laws, breaks the laws of nature. That's not the picture of the world that you have in the New Testament. That's not the picture of the world or the cosmos that ancient people would have had, that there's these immutable laws that work in a kind of mechanistic way. And therefore, to read that back into the New Testament, I think, is to misunderstand what's going on. In the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus does these deeds of power, dunamis, deeds of power. In the Gospel of John, Jesus doesn't do that. And this is where we get this language of Book of Signs or Gospel of Signs. Jesus does semeia. He does signs. The things that he does, whether they seem extraordinary or not, are signs of who he is, and therefore what he represents, namely God in the midst of the world. And so it's important to understand that when you're reading through John's gospel, all of these things that Jesus does, indeed, even his weird sayings in the gospel, according to John, he has some weird sayings, stuff like, if you wish to be my disciple, you must eat my flesh and drink my blood, right? That these are signs of who he is. They are revealing information. We're going to come back to that, but this has led certain New Testament scholars to think that there's a book of signs or a gospel of signs that underlies or is a source for the gospel according to John. I actually think that John knows about at least Mark and possibly Luke. I don't think he's doing the same thing that Matthew and Luke are doing when they copy Mark. But therefore we don't see the fingerprints of Mark in John's gospel in the way that we do in Matthew and Luke. Indeed, they're more than fingerprints in Matthew and Luke. They are the skeletal structure of the narrative structure of those gospels. I think John, the community, the Johannine community, and this is speculation. This is what Father Nick says. And Father Nick is not a New Testament scholar. I'm a lowly parish priest. But my reading of John is that we see a community that already knows Mark's gospel. And John, this is a, John's gospel represents a kind of, if Mark's gospel is your undergraduate class on who Jesus was, John's gospel is the graduate level course, the graduate seminar on who Jesus is. You already know that stuff in Mark. Now let me tell you the deeper meaning or the deeper reading of these texts. And I think that's why John's gospel will get picked up by groups such as the Gnostics and be so important to them, is that it already introduces the idea of this is the special or secret knowledge that's really just for the Christians. So we see that people who come to Jesus in secretive kind of fashion, folks like Nicodemus who comes under cover of night, he begins to receive this instruction, but because he doesn't have the basic instruction, he doesn't understand it. But Jesus is always doing these kinds of off to the side, not amid the crowd kind of moments of instruction, and the most important of which is called the Upper Room Discourse, as it takes place in the half of the gospel known as the Book of Glory, where we just get this extended teaching from Jesus in the upper room before his crucifixion that goes for chapters. But this is the deeper reading. I want to do a share screen real quick to just give one little indication of why I think John knows about Mark's gospel. And one incident isn't enough to make an argument. It would take a whole lot more study for me to do that, but I'm going to share my screen real quick. And Ross, I'd be very interested in what you think about this, this suggestion. So you can see this, right?
Yeah.
All right. So this here is the first line of Genesis in the Greek Septuagint. We have NRK epoiesin ha theos tu uranon kai tein gain. This is what you all know. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, here's John's gospel. right here, just these two lines right here. And people have long recognized that this here is referring back to this first line of Genesis in the Septuagint. In John 1:1, we get in arche in ha logos kai ha logos en proston theun kai theos en ha logos, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, here's the first line of the gospel according to Mark. And I've, for whatever reason, I've never noticed anyone mentioning this, that we have, and two words maybe aren't enough to make it worth, you know, suggesting there's a connection. But here we get, again, this word arche, arche tu euangeliu Jesu Christu huiu tu theu. So we get arche, which is beginning, and theu, God. In other words, we have shared between these three texts a few words that seem to me to suggest a little bit of a connection. If I can just take a second. The first, in Genesis chapter 1, God creates the heavens and the earth, and then we hear about how there's water, the waters of chaos, and the Spirit of God hovers above the waters of chaos. In Mark, we get the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and then immediately we move to the Jordan, and we get the waters of the Jordan, and Jesus shows up, and the Holy Spirit descends on Jesus. Jesus sees the Holy Spirit descending on him. In other words, I see a connection here between the beginning of Genesis and the beginning of Mark's gospel. And then if we look at John's prologue, again, we get this beginning echoing Genesis and the mention of God, the connection of Jesus with God. And then breaking into the prologue, we get this talk about John the Baptist that almost doesn't seem to fit the prologue. You know, the prologue's going along. Let me pull it up here and in my New Testament. So if you look at John chapter 1, And we began, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. We get this creation, this note of creation there. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. All of that's clearly referencing to Genesis. But then we get a kind of break in verse 6. Verses 6 through 8, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came for testimony to bear witness to the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness to the light. And then it goes back into the prologue in verse 9. And it keeps jumping back and forth between this prologue and this talk about John. When we get down to verse 14 in John 1, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory, glory as the only Son from the Father. And another mention of John the Baptist. John bore witness to him and cried, This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me, for he was before me. And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. I skipped ahead. I wanted to point out in 12 and 13, verses 12 and 13, we hear about how anyone who believe in Jesus will receive power to become children of God, who were not born of, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And of course, in Mark's gospel, as soon as Jesus comes up out of the waters and sees the Spirit of God descend on him, he is declared a child of God, right? He's declared the Son of God by the voice from heaven. I could go on, but my point is just that I think that Mark seems to be reflecting on Genesis 1 in the way he opens his gospel. And John has recognized this. John, who knows Mark's gospel, has made the connection clearer and is now giving us the deeper meaning of the first chapter of John is or the first chapter of Mark is essentially, or the first section of Mark is explicated theologically by the first chapter of John. I almost see John in that way as a kind of theological commentary on the gospel according to Mark. I'm going to stop there. I could go on for a long time about this, and we need to move on. But I'd be really interested, Ross, in what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I think this is a really interesting proposal. And another example of John making explicit what is implicit in the Gospels would be the multiplication of the loaves and the fish. In the Synoptic Gospels, this is one of the few things, pericope, that the Synoptics and John share. And one of the interesting things about the Synoptics versus John on this is that the Synoptics show the miracle as Jesus with power over the elements, over the natural world. Whereas in John's gospel, you get the same miracle, but the discourse on it is Jesus declares himself to be the very bread of life, which seems to be going much deeper, much farther, and much more detail about the nature of Jesus as the one who gives life. So in the case of the Synoptics, he has the power over the natural world. But in the case of John's gospel, he is the very stuff of life itself. I am the bread of life. So that would be, I think, another example. It's not grounded quite as specifically in textual material as you're describing, but I think it's a fairly easy to grasp how John might be developing or making explicit what is implicit in the Synoptics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people who've listened to me talk enough know that one of the things I like to point out is that in John's gospel, we never actually see Jesus get baptized. Similarly, we never actually see Jesus take, bless, break, and give the bread and wine of the Last Supper to his disciples. The Last Supper happens kind of off stage, just like the baptism of Jesus happens off stage. And yet, in John's gospel, we have all of this reflection on these signs or sacraments of baptism and Eucharist. Indeed, when Jesus is, when we would expect to hear a story of Jesus being baptized in John, what we get instead is John the Baptist pointing out Jesus and saying, "Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." In other words, we get a Eucharistic image that we'll see show up again and when Jesus is crucified, the association of Jesus with the sacrificial lamb. When we expect to see Jesus saying the words of institution and having his Last Supper with his disciples after his long teaching, what we get instead is Jesus washing the feet of his disciples. And of course, Peter says, "Oh no, you're not going to wash my feet." And Jesus says, if you're not washed, you have no part in me. And then Peter says, "Well, then wash all of me." And Jesus says, "You've already been washed." So we get, in other words, a baptismal image where we're expecting the Last Supper. We get a Eucharistic image where we're expecting the baptism of Jesus, and a baptismal image where we're expecting the Eucharist, the establishment of the Eucharist with the Last Supper. This playing with these two signs or sacraments runs all throughout John. And again, I think it's because John's community already knows Mark's gospel. They already know Jesus gets baptized. They already know Jesus institutes the Last Supper. Now John's gospel is going to take you into a deeper understanding of what these signs mean and how they're actually connected. And I think that transitions us nicely into themes. So are there some other themes that you wanted to raise up, Ross?
Sure. Well, we've talked about the theme of conflict, and in particular, conflict between the Messianic Jews, those who accept Jesus as Messiah, and those who do not. This leads to a second theme and a related theme, which is the basic theme of, I'm going to use the word dualism, and I'll explain what I mean in a second. In John, you get these very sharp contrasts between light and dark, between above and below, between children of God, children of the devil. There are these very striking dualistic images where you have one opposite placed off the other. And dualism, this way of looking at the world, often emerges from communities that feel oppressed or feel that they are in some ways in the minority. There's a tendency to see the world in these kind of stark black and white terms. When we talked about apocalyptic literature in relation to the Pauline epistles, we talked about this similar theme. So one of the things to watch out for as you read the Gospel of John is to see these really striking contrasts being born from above, born from below, light and darkness, up and down. That's a significant theme in John's Gospel. Something else to note is how John interacts with the Old Testament. One of the observations that readers of John's Gospel have frequently made is that he doesn't seem to quote from the Old Testament the way that the synoptics do. Remember, the synoptics, almost every page or every other page, there's, especially in Matthew and in Luke, we see a reference to as it was written in the Old Testament or to fulfill the scriptures. This is a theme, particularly in Matthew. And you don't get the same kind of referencing of the Old Testament in John's Gospel, exact quotations. At the same time, the Old Testament themes are very much present in the Gospel of John. They're just more subtle. They don't come across the same way. So, for example, the image of Jesus as the King of Israel. This is or the servant of God, the servant of Yahweh. These are deep Old Testament themes. The servant theme, particularly coming from Isaiah. So just note as you read John's Gospel that there's a deep understanding and awareness of the Hebrew Scriptures, but the themes come across slightly differently than they do in the synoptics. A related theme is the way that John uses the feasts of the Passover and the tabernacles. These are kind of nodal points in the Gospel of John where big themes emerge as Jesus reveals who he is in relation to these feasts. And part of what seems to be going on there is that John is presenting Jesus as the fulfillment or the deepening of the meaning of the, especially of the Passover. So that's another Old Testament related theme in the Gospel of John. I think those are the kind of most prominent ones that I wanted to mention. What strikes you as being particularly unusual or striking, salient Johannine themes?
Yeah, I think I would agree with all those. I mean, it's interesting to see it is dualistic, and yet it's not dualistic in a unthoughtful manner. So we often see one of the, as you pointed out, one of the dualisms or dichotomies that shows up in the text is between, the world, which is in Greek is cosmos, and Christ himself and those who are Christ's. And yet, of course, we get that famous verse, made popular by folks at football games. For God so loved the world, the cosmos, that he gave his only son. So there's a dichotomy, there's a dualism. You definitely don't want to be of the world that rejects Jesus. And yet there's also a sense that that it's for the sake of the world that Jesus comes, and that he's seeking the salvation of the world. One theme that I'd like to lift up that you didn't mention is, and it's another difference between John's gospel and the synoptics, is the main content of Jesus's teaching in the synoptics is this phrase, the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven, as we find it in Matthew. And that phrase is noticeably lacking. It's you don't find it in John's gospel. You get instead the sense of the age of ages, or the everlasting or abundant life. Did you want to say anything about that, or?
No, I think keep going. I think you're on a roll.
Okay. Well, anyway, so it's just one of those interesting things where I think that we saw in Luke a move towards really identifying Jesus as what's sometimes called the autobasileus, that he himself is the kingdom. The kingdom is wherever Jesus is present. And I think we get a similar thing in John, that without mentioning the kingdom of God, all of the things about the kingdom of God, like the resurrection of the dead, are present in Jesus. And so if you are in Jesus, if you are part of Jesus, then you are already kind of in the kingdom. And so he doesn't mention this language of the kingdom of God. But it's one of those striking things that I think differentiates John from the synoptics.
Yeah, and just picking up on your earlier point about John's dualism being a qualified dualism, or to put it more positively, John's gospel has been used probably more than any of the gospels to show that Jesus is the incarnation of God the Father in the world, the presence of God in the world that God has made. This is a very prominent theme in John, and it's related to John's high Christology. So I think that's it's important to say that the light versus darkness, children of God versus, in one place he talks about children of the devil, it becomes quite polemical, that ultimately the dualism is overcome by the fact that Jesus, as the incarnation of God, has come into this world and resides in this world. And it's really John's gospel, more than any of the others, that was used in the development of the doctrine of the incarnation, though the others were important as well. But it's a particularly striking Johannine theme.
Yeah, that's great. I feel like we could probably go on for quite a while talking about John, but I think maybe we need to go ahead and switch over to the epistles. Does that work?
That sounds great. Yep.
So we'll start with 1 John. Now, some scholars, this is called an epistle. Again, this is towards the back of your New Testament. The epistles of John come right after the two epistles of Peter, before the epistle of Jude, and then right after the epistle of Jude is the book of Revelation. So you'll find 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John between 2nd Peter and Jude. And what you'll notice about 1 John is at the very beginning is that it doesn't have a greeting like a normal letter would have, an epistle would have, which that and some other reasons have led scholars to think that perhaps 1 John wasn't an epistle or a letter at all, but possibly an early Christian sermon from the Johannine community. And this is as opposed to 2 and 3 John, which are much shorter and do have the literary form of an epistle or a letter. And these would probably have been written sometime after the Gospels, though I wasn't able to find a particular date for them. How about you, Ross?
The same, yeah. I think, you know, roughly the same period as the Gospel of John, but I didn't find a hard date, early second century at the very latest.
Right. There's some themes in here that I want to lift up, particularly a theme that I'll call anti-docetism, and then a theme, especially in the two epistles, about hospitality. But I think maybe before I do that, Ross, did you want to introduce these epistles with a little bit more information?
Well, yeah, and I'd like to come at them a slightly way than normally we approach them. And the typical way to approach these letters is to start with 1 John, and then 2 John, and 3 John. But the order is somewhat arbitrary in terms of how they were placed in the canon. And there's some wisdom in starting with 2 and 3 John and then backing into 1 John. 2 John and 3 John are written by the elder, as Nick has already mentioned. And they seem to be addressed to a community that is in significant turmoil, a community that is divided. In one case, there's a question of hospitality. Nick will say a bit more about that in a minute. In another case, there seems to be some questions about a leader who's claiming authority for himself and trying to undermine the elder. So 2 John is written to the elect lady. It's the only epistle addressed to a female. A lot of people think that that's actually a kind of symbolism for addressing the church. And the children of the elect lady are the members of the congregation. But there seems to be some sort of power play going on where someone is undermining the elder's authority. And there's also a doctrinal issue. There are some questions about whether the true faith is being affirmed. So you get both power dynamics and also questions about what constitutes genuine belief in the community. And if that's the background, then it might explain 1 John as a kind of fully developed message that goes into especially some of the doctrinal differences. So if you want a sort of a quick way into the epistles, one way to do it would be to start with 2 and 3 John, and it just takes a few minutes to read them, and you'll get a sense of some of the dynamics going on that seem to suggest conflict and divisions. And these are obviously issues that continue to trouble the church. Shall I say a bit more about 1 John?
Sure. If you want to go ahead and introduce the themes and that, and then I might just jump in from time to time.
In 1 John, the doctrinal issues seem to become more pronounced. In 1 John verse 2, chapter 2, verse 9, there's a description of those who have gone out from us. So people who've actually left the community and departed from the community. And there are also references to false prophets and to a series of unorthodox beliefs. I think probably the central theme, the key theme or key verse in 1 John would be chapter 2, verse 19. Nick, if you have that close at hand, would you mind reading 1 John 2, 19?
Sure. So chapter 2, verse 19. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us, but they went out, that it might be plain that they all are not of us.
So this is referring to some sort of painful division where members of the community departed. And as you read through 1 John, it seems as if some of their beliefs were the reason for their departing from the community. It's a little bit hard to tell exactly what the beliefs are that are being criticized in this letter, but one suggestion is that they seem to have been denying Jesus as God come in the flesh, because there are these statements where John says, anyone who denies that Jesus has come in the flesh is not of the true, not of the true faith. So some question about what the exact nature of the doctrinal disputes, but an affirmation about Christ as truly incarnate. There's some deep affirmations in 1 John. There's an affirmation of God as transcendent. There's an affirmation of God as love. This is a big theme in the Johannine literature, the new commandment, God is love. And in John's epistle, 1 John, there's this repetition of God as love. And then third, an emphasis on the love of God as expressed through love of neighbor. How do you actually love God? You love God by loving your neighbor. So those are just a couple of, a little snapshot of some of the background to 1 John. 2nd and 3rd John give you this picture of divisions in the community, power play on the one hand, doctrinal divisions on the other hand. And in 1 John, things have developed to the point where people have left the community and set up some other kind of community. And there's some clarification about the nature of the doctrinal conflicts.
Great. So what I'll do is I'd like to maybe start with the hospitality issues, especially addressed in 3rd John, and then maybe deal with some of the doctrinal, since I think the doctrinal will be a little bit heavier. The hospitality issues should sound familiar. If you read through the third letter of John, third epistle of John, remember that the early church, the first century church, they don't have public buildings. We've talked about this before, especially when we talked about the Didache and the Q Gospel or the Q Source. They don't have public buildings. Instead, they worship in each other's homes, and there seems to be a great deal of itinerancy, wandering teachers or wandering prophets. And we already see, for example, we talked about in the Didache, how there's some concerns over differentiating true wandering prophets or wandering Christians who need to be welcomed into the community for worship, but also need a place to stay. And those who, you want to be wary of because they're just taking advantage of hospitality. And we see some of that addressed in the third epistle of John. Encouragement to accept a true brother or sister into your home, both for worship and for a place to stay. We also see this in Paul's letters too. When he commends someone to a community, he's essentially saying, it's okay to let this person in to the house church during worship. It's okay to let them, to provide them hospitality, a place to stay. Did you want to say any more about that before we move on to the doctrinal issues, Ross?
No, I think you covered that nicely. It's just worth mentioning the names of the people. I always have to look at this to remind myself. It's Demetrius has received good testimony from everyone. So he's sending Demetrius, the elders, sending Demetrius. The one who is causing all kinds of issues in 3 John is Diotrephes. I have written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. And some people think that the "I have written something to the church" is referring to 1 John, that that's the writing that is referred to in 3 John. So Demetrius is the kind of the bearer of the message, and the troublemaker here is this other person, Diotrephes.
So we see some tensions there. We really see the tensions over these doctrinal issues that are mentioned in the second epistle of John and in 1 John. It might be, as you're saying, Ross, alluded to in the third epistle of John also. We know that in the second and third centuries, and even up for some time after that, that different schools of Christian thought, and I think we talked about this last Wednesday, a school of thought was these schools of thought were called heresies, which is where we get the word heresy from. But at this point, it's not that kind of loaded term that it is for us now. There's certain schools of Christian thought, certain heresies, will interpret Jesus's incarnation in a very different way than we do, and that we see in the New Testament than, say, Paul does or the Gospels do. Namely, this group, or some of these groups, will have a view that is known as docetic. This comes from the Greek word dokein, and which means to seem. And these schools of Christian thought that would later be rejected, they believed so much in the divinity of Christ that they could not accept his full humanity. Now, usually, today we tend to operate in the other direction. We're pretty sure Jesus was a historical fellow, but we're not at all sure that he was God. In the early centuries of the church, there were people who were convinced Jesus was God or a God, some kind of divine being, but not they questioned whether he had come in the flesh, that he truly had taken on a human nature. And this is because they just could not believe that the divine would sully itself in the grittiness of earthly life. In fact, what made God divine was his separation from and distance, his transcendence above the dirtiness and the grittiness and of changeable life. And they just couldn't believe that he would really take on human flesh. So instead, they taught that he seemed to take on human flesh. He took on the appearance of humanity, but he wasn't actually physically, materially human. It was just an illusion. And we know that this is a position held by these certain Christian schools later in the second and third century. And so we assume that that seems to be what 1 John and 2 John are talking about. Obviously, they don't use the terminology of these later schools, but when we look at, for example, 1 John 1, or I'm sorry, 1 John 4, beginning at the 7th verse, is that where I'm looking for? Or maybe not. Hold on just a second. I had it. I think I've lost it. I know it's chapter 4. Oh, I'm sorry. Beginning at the first verse, I was right the first time. So, beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are of God, for many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit which confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit which does not confess Jesus is not of God. This is the spirit of Antichrist, of which you heard that it was coming, and now it is in the world already. So this seems to be the doctrinal issue that has separated this community. It's the question of over whether or not Jesus truly took on human flesh, truly took on a human nature, which includes our fleshiness. And so when we see that in 1 John and in 2 John as an issue, then we can go back to the Gospel of John and we see that it shows up in there. It shows up in the prologue. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. It also shows up in the resurrection appearances. Remember doubting Thomas's problem. He did not believe in the fleshiness of the resurrected Jesus. He wanted to put his hands in the wounds, that is, feel the flesh. Remember again, Jesus's Eucharistic sayings in the gospel according to John, unless you eat my flesh, and my flesh is true food. This emphasis on the fleshiness in the gospel reflects this issue that we see was a point of contention and division within the Johannine community. Many of the docetics will like a lot of the things that we see in John's gospel, but they'll not focus on the bits that are clearly meant to ground Jesus's incarnation in the flesh. Ross, did you want to say anything about that?
No, I think it's really, really well said. And I've heard it described that the prologue to John's gospel at the beginning would makes a series of statements that Gnostics would agree with about the creation and the Word and the Logos and, you know, these affirmations of God, the Word. And so you can sort of imagine them hearing this being read and shaking their heads and saying, yeah, that really is great. You know, the Word was at present in creation, until it comes to the place where it says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And at that point, you know, a card-carrying Gnostic would say, no, I'm out of here. That's not what I believe. So it seems to be a very explicit denial or it can be interpreted as an explicit denial of a Gnostic or docetic approach to God and to the world.
Yeah, we've been focused on the first century so much, and we will move, as we move along, we'll begin to move into the second century and talk about some of these issues like Gnosticism and Doceticism and some of these debates that will come up. But I also want to mention, this is still a live issue, I think, in the church. Even though I said, you know, for a lot of us in the modern day, we have no problem believing Jesus was human. We have a tougher, you know, it can be tougher for us to confess his divinity. There are, within the church, I think, movements. And I want to be careful about saying this because I often think that it's not intentional. I don't think that they mean to be recapitulating some of these ancient heresies. But movements to separate the humanity, the fleshiness of Jesus from his divinity in this way. So maybe not denying the historicalness, the historicity, I guess is the better word, of Jesus, but separating the divinity of Jesus from the peculiarity of his historicity in such a way that it's almost incidental that Jesus, this historical person, was the Son of God. And what I have in mind here are books and you know, popular literature that will speak of things like Christ consciousness as something separate from Jesus, and therefore some Jesus just happened to tap into Christ consciousness. Another phrase that you'll sometimes hear is the cosmic Christ, who's greater than Jesus, and just kind of Jesus is one kind of expression of that. All of these I see as, in some sense, modern forms of the same kind of docetic bent that the Gospel according to John and the Epistles of John are trying to correct and say, no, you really need to understand that God, you know, loves us so much that he got involved in the dirty grittiness of human life by becoming one of us. You know, it's not just people participate in this spiritual consciousness or greater divine, you know, I don't even know what you call it, just a cloud in the sky or something, but God actually took human flesh and walked with us and talked with us and actually, and this is an important part too, actually died on the cross. Because for these later docetics, not only did Jesus not actually take human flesh, not only did he seem to be human, but he also only seemed to die on the cross. He wasn't actually crucified. I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but it does seem to me that kind of inadvertently, there are forms of modern Christianity that are kind of recapitulating, bringing forward into our own time versions of these very same controversies. And Ross, you are staying wisely silent on this issue.
Well, I have noticed in Bible studies over the years that, at least in the circles that I've moved in, when discussing Jesus and how much he knew and how much power he had, we're often quite, the tendency is to assume that Jesus knew things by virtue of being the Son of God, or that he had the power to do certain things by virtue of being the Son of God, rather than really coming to grips with the limitations of his humanity. That's a slightly different issue than what you're describing about the cosmic Christ and so forth. But I do think that there's a tendency, I think it's a little bit harder for us really to come to grips with the true humanity of the Lord as we see him on the pages of the New Testament, because he is just, you know, so incomparably different from us, and seems to inhabit such a different sphere spiritually, that it's important to remember that he had all the same limitations that we have.
Yeah. No, it's a great word. And it reminds me, and maybe I'll go ahead and close on this. One final thought is that I've sometimes heard people say that the Synoptic Gospels represent the human nature of Christ, and John's Gospel represents the divine nature. And I think that that's to misunderstand the incarnation. What the incarnation means, and what the Council of Chalcedon in the 5th century teaches us, is that the divine and human natures can never be separated out in the one person of Jesus. They're distinct, but they can never be separated in the one person of Jesus. And that's true whether you're reading the Gospel according to Mark or you're reading the Gospel according to John. Because even though John's Gospel definitely gives us this kind of like I said, the graduate seminar in high Christology gives us the deeper teaching, the special teaching that we get as insiders in a sense. Nevertheless, even as it's expounding what it means for Jesus to be the incarnate God, it's the text that tells us that when Lazarus dies, you know, we get the shortest verse in all the New Testament. Jesus wept. You know, it's the gospel. It doesn't pretend that Jesus is not human. And this is I think, the lesson of all the gospels, that the divinity of Christ is manifest in his humanity. And as you say, struggling with that and trying to wrap our minds about that, that's the work of Christian discipleship and the Christian life. So I think that's all I need to say. Ross, any final words from you?
No, thank you, Nick. I appreciate it. I look forward to exploring these themes. And as we prepare for Wednesday night, I'll be interested in hearing from members of the group how they experience John's gospel and what about it seems different, what's more attractive, maybe more difficult, just how it rests on the ears compared to the synoptics.
Sounds good. All right. Take care, Ross.
Thanks, Nick. See you tomorrow. Mm-hmm.